The Jason Rance Show.
Jason Rance hosts a radio show in Seattle, and he has, as always, the details for us exclusively.
Jason Rance, our Seattle guy, is with us now.
Jason Rance, always great to have you in focus. Thank you.
Hey, Jason, I think you're all right, and thanks for being on the show.
An update on what's happening in your Pacific Northwest.
Ron DeSantis is ready for a fight. We'll tell you what he said. It's okay to fail. A lot of tech companies are realizing it, but it's something that we can all learn from as well. Plus, Spencer Hutchins is a state House candidate who is hanging on to a slim lead. Will he pull it off? He'll join us to discuss this hour of the Jason Rance Show. So let's get into it.
The monologue.
Now, without getting too much into the weeds, because when you even mention the word budget, it's very, very boring. But it is budget season for the Seattle City Council. And this is a city that is dealing with a significant shortfall, over $200 million, because it spends outside of its means. It spends way more than it brings in. So naturally, they decided, we're going to actually spend even more money, and we're going to pay for abortions. They want to pay for abortions. It's very interesting, because what they're unwilling to pay for is public safety. They're unwilling to pay for the Seattle Police Department to fully function. So Bruce Harrell puts in a budget. Then, of course, the way it works is the council looks at it and says, okay, we like this, we'll keep this. We don't like that, we'll get rid of that. Sometimes they just say, yeah, we're not even going to pretend to care about what's in your budget. We'll use some of the bones that you put together to save us some time, and we'll do our own thing. And they appear to be leaning more in that direction, even though this was a budget that apparently the council members participated in. But they do not get along. The council and this mayor's office, they do not get along. Teresa Mosqueda, she is a Seattle city councilwoman. She is someone who hates cops. She is someone who defended a man threatening to murder cops on video. I broke that story. It's still available if you want to find it over at KTTH.com. She hates cops. And so she decided to try to defund the police. Now she's going to pretend that this is not defunding the police. And there's no doubt going to be media outlets like the Seattle Times that will frame this in a way that suggests it's not defunding the police, when that's exactly what it's doing. That's exactly what she's trying to do. Now, Bruce Harrell temporarily cut $11 million from the Seattle Police Department budget. They did this for one reason. They had budgeted to fill 200 positions. There's no way on God's green earth that they are going to hire even close to 200 officers. So Bruce Harrell, noting the fact that from a budget perspective, things are not looking so good, decided to, for this year only, cut $11 million and only fund up to 120 positions to be filled. Which, by the way, unfortunately, they're not even going to fill those positions. But this was a smart, short-term solution to a budgeting issue. Now, I understand why the Seattle Police Officers Guild, and we'll talk with its president, Mike Sullivan, I get why they don't want that to happen at all. Believe me, I get it. But it is temporary. Mosqueda then put in an amendment that said, actually, I'm going to make this cut permanent. We're never going to give you back that $11 million. You're going to have to try to beg us, convince us to give you that $11 million if you ever want to see it again. She's doing this because she wants to defund the police. She's doing this despite the fact that we have a police department that has been decimated because of people like her. The anti-cop majority on the council that have existed this entire time, defunding the police, demoralizing the police, smearing the police. She is the reason why, in large part, we are suffering so much. And when you don't have a police force and yet you have Democrats in state office pushing anti-police policies, pro-criminal policies, that's a recipe for disaster. One that we're seeing right now, record high crime, violent crime, non-violent crime, surging through the roof. And yet, rather than correct the mistakes, you have someone like Mosqueda who's out there defunding even more. And no one in the media will talk about this honestly. No one will call this what it is. It's nothing more than defunding part, what, three?
The interview.
All eyes on the race for Spencer Hutchins, who's running for House Representative to fill the now vacated seat by Jesse Young. He's currently in the lead by a very slim margin, and he joins me now. Spencer, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you, Jason. Thank you.
So we're going to get numbers within the next 10 to 20 to 30 minutes or so, even later into the evening. We'll see how they get reported. How are you feeling right now as you hang on to, what, a couple dozen vote lead?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're in a good position, but anyone who is hanging on to a lead that's, you know, less than half a point, we're about 0.4% in the lead right now. You know, you're not running around dancing a jig, yeah. But we are certainly in a good position. And the longer the vote goes, the more difficult it is to make up a margin, even a small one like this. So I'm confident and hopeful that we will come out ahead in the end, but it's a tight one.
Yeah, and in fairness, it's a little bit more than a couple dozen, although there are some races that are like that. Chris Gilday comes to mind. He'll be on the show tomorrow. When you look at numbers like this and the amount that are still to come in, is the thinking that these are votes that traditionally are Republican votes just because they're coming in at the last minute?
Well, that would be, you know, sort of stereotypical thinking. I think it's important to drill down a little bit more. And most of these votes, I estimate somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,000 votes likely left to be counted, and they are predominantly in Kitsap County. Now, late-breaking votes tend to break Republican. However, Kitsap County, your listeners may know if they're looking at the vote totals, is where I'm down. I'm leading on the Pierce County side of my district, and I am down in the Kitsap County side of the line. So, you know, we hope that those late breaking votes continue to move in a Republican direction. But given that they are on the side of the line that I'm trailing, it, you know, it's really anyone's guess who those votes are, where they come from, what, you know, and what they're ultimately going to break down as.
Do you have a sense as to how many votes need to be cured in both counties?
The sense was somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 could be, and we'll see, you know, how many of those have been. There's an ongoing effort.
How much is the party helping you at this point in dealing with what could potentially be now a move to get people to cure their ballots if they think it's going to put you over the line?
There is definitely a party operation going on to, you know, to make sure we are curing ballots and getting, you know, getting those votes that we can. So I'm grateful for the support. And obviously we had a Senate race here that is very, very tight as well. You know, it remains to be seen how outstanding votes go in the Jesse Young, Emily Randall race. But there's been an effort to, you know, to rehab as many rejected ballots as possible that could be helpful.
What does that process look like? Because there are some people who they don't check their ballots, and every single person should check your ballot. Just make sure that it was counted. But some folks are saying it hasn't been counted yet. It's been accepted but not counted. Some of them are saying it's on hold because of a signature issue. What is the process afterwards for people to follow up?
So there is an affidavit that the county can receive and accept from someone whose ballot has been rejected to allow them to have their vote counted. And the counties should be sending out notices to people whose ballots have been rejected. But the party operation also has the list. And so people may be contacted by volunteers saying, hey, your ballot was, you know, rejected, or the signature didn't match. And here's the process to get that ballot rehabbed.
And for some folks, you're not going to get your ballot in, or you're not going to get your letter in, depending on when you ended up voting. So if you voted at the last minute, for example, you've got some people in Skagit County, the votes haven't been tallied yet, you might get your letter with some delay. So the way to get around this, just instead of waiting for the letter to actually get delivered, just go to voter.votewa.gov and you just put in your information. You can find it out there. Do you get frustrated by the, I don't know, lack of speed, as it were, to get this information out there to count the ballots?
Yeah, it can be a little confusing. I mean, you know, we see across the country different approaches to counting of ballots. And it's just interesting to see a state like Florida, with a population substantially higher than Washington, getting their votes counted in one day. And here we are exactly a week after the election, still wondering what these razor thin margins are going to come down to. It does beg the question, why, and how can we make this vote counting process, you know, more expeditious? Obviously, we have a mail-in voting system, which means some votes aren't coming until several days after the election. But nevertheless, we have days and days later, 30, 40,000 votes left in a legislative district still uncounted. That seems odd to me, and I'm very interested in looking into what we can do to make our vote counting process more responsive and more immediate, because it really is unfair to the citizens to be a week and a half or more out from an election and still not know.
Well, I hope to have you back on as a state representative who vows to look into this particular issue, but that all depends on getting those votes in your direction. So again, folks, check to see if your vote was accepted, if it was delivered. You can go online to voter.votewa.gov. If you're listening to me right now in Bremerton, Port Orchard, Olalla, Gig Harbor, you live in this particular district. Everyone should do it. But if you're listening right now in those cities, please make sure you're checking your ballot. Spencer Hutchins, good luck.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Jason.
Now this.
The monologue.
We're about 45 minutes, a little over 45 minutes away from former President Donald Trump announcing he is going to run for president again. It's a speech that will start at 6 o'clock. It's a speech that there are, frankly, a lot of folks on the right, at least in the media class, and some of the activist community are saying, please don't do it. Don't announce today. Don't announce. And the reasons behind that depends on the person who's delivering that message. Some of it has to do with not wanting to overshadow the Georgia Senate race. I fall into that category. Others, while acknowledging that's an issue, also just don't think he can win. Now, I'm not entirely sure I believe that. I think it's going to be tough. I think that every single media outlet outside of the conservative ones will be acting in bad faith trying to defeat him. And I don't want someone to run if they're not going to be capable of winning, even if I like their policies and even if I liked, in this case, his past presidency. There's also a lot of folks who are saying now's the time to just go with Governor DeSantis. He's got the momentum after the midterm wins, the red wave that clearly happened in Florida. He's well-liked. He's the most popular governor, Republican governor in this country. He's doing things the right way. Now, there have been some reports suggesting he said privately that he wouldn't run against Donald Trump if he announced. I don't know if I believe that. He's certainly talking like he's willing to go up against Donald Trump. This happened earlier today.
Well, you know, one of the things I've learned in this job is when you're leading, when you're getting things done, yeah, you take incoming fire. That's just the nature of it. I roll out of bed in the morning. I've got corporate media outlets that have a spasm just the fact that I'm getting up in the morning, and it's constantly attacking. And this is just what's happened. I don't think any governor got attacked more, particularly by corporate media, than me over my 4-year term. And yet, I think what you learn is all that's just noise. And really what matters is, are you leading? Are you getting in front of issues? Are you delivering results for people? And are you standing up for folks? And if you do that, then none of that stuff matters. And that's what we've done. We focused on results and leadership. And, you know, at the end of the day, I would just tell people to go check out the scoreboard from last Tuesday night. The fact of the matter is, you know, the fact of the matter is, it was the greatest Republican victory in the history of the state of Florida.
Now, when he says, look at the scoreboard, part of the reason he's doing that is because people have said that Trump candidates did not do so well. DeSantis-backed folks did. That's what that is. A little bit of a passive-aggressive, offensive push against Trump. You're going to have to get used to that. I don't like to have to see these two people go up against each other, because I don't want to see any of them harmed, because one of them will become the nominee. And I think we need to go into it very, very strong, not weak. But people are making a very strong argument for Ron DeSantis, and I do think it holds water. The question will become, will the base believe that? And well, I guess we're going to find out, forced to find out, later tonight.
The interview.
Well, a lot is on the line right now in Georgia, as you have Herschel Walker taking on the incumbent Democrat Raphael Warnock. So what needs to happen to ensure a Republican win? Joining me on the line is RNC Southeast Regional Comms Director Savannah Vyer. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you so much for having me.
So you were there covering this for the RNC, handling a lot of what was going on the ground, particularly in Atlanta. What makes you think the dynamics for a special election will go in Herschel Walker's favor?
I think the dynamics are different because I think that Herschel Walker has momentum on his side. The fact that Raphael Warnock outspent Herschel Walker 3-1 and still could not get over the 50+1% threshold that is needed to win outright in the state of Georgia proves that Georgians don't want Raphael Warnock. They want Herschel Walker, and we are all in it together here in Georgia, working hard to get him across the finish line in December.
What I think, you know, anyone can reasonably suggest that Herschel Walker benefited from Brian Kemp on the ticket, right? I mean, people showed up in droves to vote for him, and presumably someone who's voting for Brian Kemp is going to be slightly more likely to vote for Herschel Walker if there may be an independent. With Brian Kemp not on the ballot, and this is just Herschel Walker versus Raphael Warnock, what needs to get done to ensure the ground game is strong and people actually show up?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Well, in terms of ground game, we have at the RNC sent a total of 400 staffers. By the end of this week, it'll be 400 staffers to Georgia to help catapult Herschel Walker across the finish line. This builds on the already impressive ground game that we had in the state of Georgia that did help work in tandem with Governor Kemp and Herschel Walker's team before the November election. And so we just have a lot of people on the ground that are working together to make sure that we can turn out our base. I do think that our base in Georgia is bigger than the Democrat base. We saw that with the number that turned out for Stacey Abrams. Mm-hmm. She came up short, and we can surpass that number if we turn out the vote of our base.
What's the messaging now that we have results in Nevada and Arizona that obviously didn't go the way that we had hoped they would?
Yeah. So the messaging is that this is a race for Georgia. This is a race so that Georgia actually has someone at the table in Washington. Raphael Warnock went up to Washington, D.C., and he voted with Joe Biden 96% of the time. He has repeatedly failed to deliver for the people of Georgia, whereas Herschel Walker, he is a Georgian. He loves this state. We've seen it throughout the decades, and he is going to go and be a voice for the Georgia people in Washington, D.C. It also is important to note that, you know, the 2024 Senate elections will be coming around the bend as well. Mm-hmm. So we could be looking at, you know, a majority of that, but we have to win this Georgia race to help parlay that in the future.
But how much of the national politics motivate voters there? Obviously, when you don't know you're going to lose the Senate control completely if you don't vote for the Republican or for the, you know, whoever it is, it takes a slightly different role than when you know that if we lose this, Democrats have 51 votes. And, you know, one could argue 51 is still not quite what it means because of, you know, Sinema and Manchin. But symbolically, there's obviously a lot to be said about having total control like that of the Senate.
Absolutely. I mean, this is to make sure that there is, you know, one more Republican voice at the table, which does impede Democrats from being able to just have carte blanche rule over the Senate. So it is important that we do keep it at the 50-50 level, and we don't give a 51st seat to Raphael Warnock.
What are some of the issues that people are talking about on the ground? How similar is it to what we've seen in some of the exit polls nationally?
Very similar. We're seeing a lot of focus on inflation, mm-hmm. on gas prices. You know, thankfully, Governor Kemp signed the gas tax, and so we haven't seen as bad gas prices as some other states that have not done that. But it just goes to show that Republican leadership does matter, and Republican leadership at the state level is what we need to take to the federal level as well. So I would say that inflation is a big deal, and the border crisis. You know, we've seen rainbow fentanyl. We've seen massive fentanyl overdoses, especially in the Deadly Triangle, which is the north part of Atlanta and the Atlanta suburbs. These are affecting everyone here in Georgia, and the only way to push back on that is to have Republican leadership at every level.
Yeah, Democrats right now quite literally trying to cheat the system. They are suing to allow voting on the Saturday after Thanksgiving in this particular race, despite the law quite literally saying you can only open on the following Monday. Obviously, they're doing that in a desperation move. They want some extra time to get people out to the votes, which I think goes to your earlier comment about just the ground game and the interest from Republican voters is relatively high. It might be a little bit more difficult to get out some of the Democrats. But when they pull a stunt like that and they do it so openly, what does it tell you about their side?
It tells me that they're scared that they can't get their voters out to vote, and that they need to try whatever antics they think are going to work. But at the end of the day, we've got momentum on our side and they do not. And so they're scrambling to try to find whatever they can to try to put the thing in their favor.
Yeah, but they're saying that you guys are the ones cheating. I'm looking at a quote and it's just such horrible gaslighting. Quinton Folks from the Warnock for Georgia campaign manager. Illegal attempts to block Saturday voting are another desperate attempt by career politicians to squeeze the people out of their own democracy and to silence the voices of Georgians. And yet the law states, quote, there shall be a period of advance voting that shall commence on the fourth Monday immediately prior to a runoff from a general election in which there are candidates for federal office on the ballot in the runoff. So again, they're just flat out lying. And my sense is a quote like that, because it plays into the narrative, particularly amongst national media outlets on the left, that Republicans are stealing elections and democracy is on the line.
Yeah, and that doesn't play here in Georgia. I mean, look at how badly Stacey Abrams lost.
Yep.
Georgians know that the Democrats lie about very standard election laws that we have passed in the state of Georgia. Georgians know that Democrats lie about it. They lie about it repeatedly. I mean, an Obama-appointed judge recently overturned the lawsuit that Stacey Abrams and her group brought to them that claimed that, you know, nefarious activity took place in the 2018 gubernatorial election that she also ran in. Georgians are sick and tired of Democrats lying about these things, and they're going to show that when they go and vote, you know, at the ballot box.
Last question for you. Is the announcement tonight by the former president going to risk completely overshadowing this race? I think, again, no matter how anyone feels about his announcement, it does overshadow, at least temporarily, what's going on in Georgia.
You know, we're focused on finishing out the 2022 election cycle. So that's our focus. That's what we will keep our focus. We're going to keep the main thing, which is getting Herschel Walker across the finish line. Everything else can wait until December, 7th.
How do people here in Washington get involved and help?
Go to teamherschel.com. I'll say it again, teamherschel.com. That's the best way to get involved. You can get involved, making phone calls from afar. You can donate. Anything, any time and effort is much appreciated. It's an all hands on deck situation, and yep, we do appreciate everyone's willingness and eagerness to help us, make sure that we deliver this Senate seat for Herschel Walker.
Again, it's teamherschel.com. We've been talking with RNC Regional Communications Director Savannah Vyar. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jason. Have a good afternoon.
You as well. Now this.
The Jason Rantz Show.
Jason Rantz, thank you for being in focus.
One of these days, we're going to see the politics of Northwest and the United States change, but I don't think it's there yet.
We've got enough crime. We don't need to import it. That's for certain.
If you don't feel safe walking down the street in your own neighborhood, that can drive a lot of people to the polls.
Long Form, presented by Northgate Rare Coins and Precious Metals.
It's budget season for the Seattle City Council, and although they're trying to say this isn't defunding the police, it kind of seems like they're defunding the police again. Although they're doing it in an interesting way. Joining me on the line to discuss, Seattle Police Officer Guild President Officer Mike Solon. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Jason. Thank you.
So there's a couple issues that we should chat about when it comes to this particular budget. I spoke earlier this hour on one piece. You have Bruce Harrell. He put out his budget and just temporarily he said, okay, we're going to trim $11 million from the police budget, because there's no way in God's green earth that we are going to hire 200 officers next year. So we'll budget for 120 officers. The money comes back the year after that. Teresa Mosqueda, who just introduced a whole bunch of amendments, permanently trims that $11 million under the guise of, oh, no, this isn't defunding. We could always bring it back at some point. So what's your take?
More unreasonable activism from Councilmember Mosqueda, completely uninformed, blind by her ideology, and I think the mayor is approaching this with a common sense viewpoint, although, you know, removing money from the police budget doesn't help us. But the reality is we're not hiring right now the level that we need to hire. You chalk that to the lack of political support by our elected officials. Sure. I mean, if I'm a person looking at the Seattle Police Department as a potential place for employment, I'm thinking otherwise because of the number one thing right now, we're without a labor contract. And politically, we're still recovering from the defund nonsense. And then you still have council members that want to take away money from the police department to fulfill their own activist agenda. And that's a detriment to the community at large.
The other issue is the placement of the parking enforcement. It was given to SDOT. The mayor wanted to bring it back to SPD, although I don't know if that was going to be a permanent home. Mosqueda says no. Again, this is getting a little bit in the weeds, but what is the issue at play here?
No, I think the issue at play is the mayor is correct. The mayor knows he's trying to get control of the council, work with them politically, but Mosqueda is somebody that will continue to push the activist agenda, and it all comes down to money, period, hands down. How can they get their hands on more millions of dollars for their own activist agenda? And it's quite clear that the rift between the council and the mayor's office is real, but I would side with the mayor's office every day and twice on Sunday against the likes of Mosqueda, who continue to malign and throw police officers under the bus for her own political activist agenda.
Is there a recent incident of throwing police under the bus? Because obviously we've talked about her a lot. I was the one who broke the story of her supporting or at least defending a man who was threatening to murder police officers. She live streamed it. She didn't seem to have a problem with it. Something happened recently?
Well, I would say just the reaction politically from the tragic school shooting at the Ingram High School, when you have the support of some council members voicing support for the student body that are basically saying that they don't want violent police officers, and echoing those sentiments to me is detrimental to our community and detrimental to the police department. So we still haven't had a courageous politician who was willing to correct the record and basically say, you know what, we need to support our police officers. This police department is a modeled national symbol. And credit to us in terms of being in Department of Justice reform. And we've been reformed for the past 2 years. But as you know, DOJ is still around here spending millions of dollars of the city's tax-based money to keep them around. And that's a political problem. So, yes, it's real. The activist groups that control City Hall, they're still targeting police officers and a false narrative, and I'm going to do everything I can to block them.
And I'm glad you brought up the Ingram High School incident. By the way, we're talking with Seattle Police Officers Guild President Mike Solon, mostly because I keep hearing this nonsense claim from some students, but also from community activists about how dangerous school resource officers would be. Have there been more instances of violence committed by students or by SROs? Because it seems to be just the last year more students committed violence than SROs have in the history of the SRO program here.
Well, I think the biggest takeaway is the political move of removing SROs from schools is detrimental to not only student growth, but the safety of those students, faculty, and I would say the parents. Many of those SROs that were put in place are persons of color from the police agency, and they came from Seattle roots. So, you know, when we talk about inclusion, equity in this city, well, that's fine and dandy, but you completely polarize the police officers that are part of this community. And to me, that's such smacks in the face of just common sense, devoid of common sense. It's hypocrisy. So anybody that keeps pushing that narrative, to me, aren't leaders. They push a false narrative, and they aren't to be taken as serious people.
Yeah.
But what they're doing is serious to the detriment of our community, which is not providing public safety, which they're supposed to do.
Yeah, they're
and
unserious
again,
people who have power.
Yep, exactly. And that's a dangerous combination. So, and then you couple that with the fact that we're 500 officers down and counting. We're without a labor contract. Clearly, the rift between the city council and the mayor's office is real. And so what does that push us for a contract? You know, so we're going to side with the reasonable people. And I think the mayor is reasonable here. He's trying to balance what is a problem for his constituents, which is the entire city. And so we'll see what happens in this year when, you know, the election for next November's council races is going to heat up. I think that's going to be interesting. We're watching the moves budget-wise here in this conversation, and you're seeing the activist class represented by Mosqueda. I think they're on the outside looking in, but they feel as if they have control of the money. That means they control the conversation.
It's just, it's so curious how Teresa Mosqueda has become the new voice of those activists. It used to be Shama Sawant, who for the most part, I think mostly because she's alienated even some of her allies, they just don't like her and don't want to work for her or work with her. It's just given an opening to someone like Mosqueda to fill it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're spot on with that assessment. But it's part of the fringe groups that comprise the council. I think the council is shifting because the public safety conversation is shifting. It's just going to take a little bit more time. And I fully support what the mayor's doing, although I don't like removing the money.
Yeah.
But the reality is we're just not hiring to the level that we should be hiring. And that's real.
Yeah. If it's temporary, if it's truly temporary, and again, the budget from Harrell indicates that it's just that. I get it. I hear your perspective. No one wants to see any money going away. But look, let's be honest. The city is dealing with a budget shortfall. They're spending, by the way, $1.5 million more dollars apparently on giving out abortions. But they can't fully support the police. Last question for you. I've got a story coming out later this evening. And for those of you who are listening and want to get the sneak peek, it goes up at 6 o'clock at KTTH.com. I have a follow-up story on a principal, or at least a principal at the time at Sandpoint Elementary in Seattle. And when an officer arrived after there was a 911 call, someone had broken into the school. He assaulted a student. He stole a student's backpack. He ends up escaping because he was the officer was stonewalled by the principal. I've got this all on video. And I spent some time talking with some cops over the course of the last few months, and they tell me that they've seen an increase of instances in which school officials at Seattle schools are just not necessarily stonewalling, but being disrespectful, not being forthcoming. Have you heard any of that?
I have heard of that. And I think the only way to try to get at that is to go right to the leadership core. You know, today, earlier, I reached out to the principal at Ingram High School looking to have a conversation. I would like to talk with that student body there that has these viewpoints. But if they're being from the top down, or they're being told that police are the problem, well, then that's going to echo into these types of calls. When police respond to a crime, which is our job, and to investigate, try to assist that victim who's a student, and then faculty intervene, well, there's your number one problem. If students, meaning they, are being told one thing, that police are the problem, then you have faculty acting in this manner. Jason, we have a lot bigger problems on our hands than just trying to get recruits for police positions. We have a fundamental breakdown in our value system and our moral. It's a moral decay. And that's obviously evident with some of the faculty in these schools. That starts from the top down.
Yeah. And by the way, folks, I hope you realize that when you teach kids that cops are evil, they become adults who think cops are evil. And that means they're going to have different interactions with them when there is an inevitable interaction with an officer. It also means they won't be signing up to become a new recruit. And that leads to some of the staffing issues long term. But the short term, it's a nightmare. We're going to try to figure that out. Mike Solon is the president of the Seattle Police Officers Guild. Thank you so much for stopping by. Really appreciate it.
Good man, Jason.
Thank you. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Jason Rants, Seattle radio host, joins us now.
Jason, you're the perfect guest on this.
Jason Rants, welcome back, Jason.
I see you often on other programs here.
Jason, what's going on?
Jason, thanks for coming on.
The Quick Hit.
I don't normally find myself reading anything on CNBC's website, not because I'm disinterested in the subject matter. Obviously, they talk a lot about business, but I just don't find them to take any interesting angles ever, if I'm being totally upfront. But there was an instance today, in fact, that they took an angle that I think is worth discussing in a bigger sense. They're focusing on what's going to happen in the tech sector, in the tech industry, in the coming years. And a quote kind of jumped out at me from a CEO who says, "We will see spectacular failures." they write, once high-flying tech unicorns are now having their wings clipped as the era of easy money comes to an end. That was the message from the Web Summit tech conference in Lisbon, Portugal, or earlier this month. Startup founders and investors took to the stage to warn fellow entrepreneurs that it was time to rein in costs and focus on fundamentals. Guillaume Pouzat, the CEO of London-based payment software company Checkout.com, said, what's for sure is that the landscape of fundraising has changed. And they're looking at what they're specifically dealing with on the financial end and where money isn't necessarily coming in the way that they once thought. And you're looking at some of the investments and investors and the opportunities. They're just not there anymore. And what is hurting a lot of these companies, according to this article, and it's obviously based on the experiences of these tech managers and founders at this conference, basically saying that we're having an increase cost of capital, and it's just killing us. It is a burden. We're seeing our valuations dropping as a result of this because we just can't keep up with the capital expenditures. And some of this is an industry, and this again was a nice quote that was put up there, said it's an entire industry that got ahead of its skis. And it's coming, this conversation, in light of what's happening at Meta or Facebook, where they're letting go a whole bunch of people. 11,000 people will lose their job at Meta. You have Amazon announcing this week via a New York Times story. Hasn't been confirmed. I talked to someone over at Amazon, a source who couldn't confirm the 10,000, but not feeling so good about how many people are about to be reportedly let go. But a lot of people are going to be let go. We talk about how it's going to impact Pacific Northwest disproportionately. You have Stripe, which is a payments firm. They just laid off 14% of their employees. You had here again in Seattle, you had Seattle-based online retail firm Redfin and Zillow, real estate. They decided to let folks go as well. And what's happening here, it's not the end of the tech sector. It's not just imploding per se, but they're very clearly are getting to a point where they're having to make different decisions on what products or policies or strategies they're going to pursue. They're going to have to make a more quick decision on whether or not they're going to continue to go down a pathway that maybe right now is failing, but in the long term they think is going to work. Amazon is a good example of a company that has given a lot of space for departments or initiatives to grow, and they see failure or failure and failure and failure. And then all of a sudden, because they kept at it and they kept pouring investment money into it, then it starts to take off. They give it a long runway. But now they're saying, and they've been saying for a little bit, that that runway is getting shorter and shorter and shorter. You saw how Amazon closed its retail space. Not the Amazon Go grocery stores, but the retail shops, like the five-star shop. They just closed them around the globe. They decided, okay, too much runway here. We gave them too much runway. And now they're telling the departments that are not performing well or underperforming to the expectations, yeah, we're going to start cutting you guys too. And a lot of this had to do with the early tech sector, based out of Silicon Valley, but then obviously spread, of just throwing a ton of money at strategies and initiatives and products and ideas. Just throw a ton of money at it. And at some point, they said to themselves, well, the money is continuously coming in. This is a high investment industry. We're getting investors all over the place. We're getting money is quite almost literally growing on trees. And so let's just keep doing more and more and more. And they never said, okay, this is failing. Maybe we should just cut the cord. We should just give up on this. They just kept on putting money, pouring money into failing efforts. And now it's coming to hurt them. It was a strategy that only works when you've got endless amounts of seemingly endless amounts of money coming in. And it got me thinking about failure in a general sense, where it is okay to fail. It's okay to fail. Now, there are consequences to failure. Sometimes the consequences are felt more significantly than others, but it's okay to fail. And I feel like we do not allow for people to fail anymore. And I know it feels kind of cliche, but we have the conversations, and we often have the conversations. It used to be this kind of silly, almost hackneyed comment to make of everyone gets a participation trophy. But the fact of the matter is that has been happening. And that leads me to the last rants.
The last rants.
We have to stop getting in the way of failure when the failure that's happening is a result of a purely bad idea or someone who very clearly is not qualified to do something. Instead of just constantly telling people over and over and over again, you can get it done. You put your mind to it and you'll get everything done, anything done. Keep on trying, son. Keep on trying, lady. Keep on trying, uncle. Whatever it is, we have all those people in our lives where we've heard that. I know a lot of parents tell that to their sons and daughters. Keep on trying. You're going to succeed. I know a lot of people say that to friends and family members and coworkers. Oh, no, keep going. At some point, yeah, you're going to land that account. But the truth of the matter is, for a lot of people, for most people, for 99% of the globe, you're not always going to succeed. You're not going to have a 100% success rate. And we have taken out of the reality an acceptance of failure. In part, again, because we started to treat kids as if just showing up was somehow an accomplishment. It's not. You can't win if you don't show up, but you can lose if you show up. But instead of acknowledging that, everyone gets the trophy. And then that generation became entitled. They got older. They went to high school and college and got into the real world. And all of a sudden, growing up in a world in which they were told that your feelings are fact, that you can accomplish anything if you put your mind to it. And by the way, if you don't accomplish it, it's a result of some sort of systemic ism against you, racism, sexism, whatever. They got entitled, like they're owed something. And a lot of the folks, frankly, who are running these tech companies, or at least they used to found these tech companies, they were younger folks from that generation. They worked a lot harder, I think, than the current younger generation does. But they basically had that entitlement complex fulfilled by investors who were just throwing money at them. And just the more I think about this, the reason why the tech sector finds itself where it is not just merely because the money is starting to slow down and slow down significantly for some businesses due to economic realities, but it's just this idea that we can never say failure is an option. Failure is inevitable in many instances. Most people will fail before they succeed. Most people, before they become huge successes, whatever that means to them, failed a whole bunch of times. And the ones who fail and learn something from the failure, they become, I think, the biggest success stories, whether we're talking about it on an individual level or from a business perspective. How often did Amazon fail? And then they grew into what it became today. And they are sensing what I think a lot of other companies have already realized, that you can, you know, prolong failure to a degree that it's going to hurt you. And so now we just got to embrace the fail. And so that's what I think a lot of businesses are starting to do, which is embrace the fail. Maybe they're doing it reluctantly, but ultimately they're doing that because they want to succeed. And I think that if, as individuals, we all want to succeed, we're going to have to do that as well. Embrace the fail. Sometimes you're going to fail, and sometimes that's okay.